Welcome to another episode of the Faith Work Rest podcast. Our mission is to help people discern their vocations and reimagine their occupation for the good of their neighbor and the glory of God. We're part of the Surge Network. It's a network of local churches united to put Jesus on display in their community. You can learn more at surgenetwork.com.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Faith, Work, and Rest podcast. I'm Lauren Kutzko, and I'm here with Jim Mullins and Kimberly Deckel. And while Jim was traveling last week in Vancouver, he got to spend some time with some folks doing some interviews. And today we're going to play a great one with Gustavo Santos, and Jim's going to kind of explain who that is and what they got to talk about.
Yeah. So he's a guy who was introduced to me by Steve Garber. He is a great guy who's asking stellar questions about how the faith and work conversation can connect with the working class. A lot of this comes out of his own background. He's from Brazil, where he worked as a management consultant. And his life in Brazil and his perspective there has really shaped his questions as it relates to the faith and work conversation. And so we connected because we've kind of have those questions in common. He's a recent graduate of Regent College. He got his MA in Marketplace Theology. And now he's in sort of one of the leaders in the Master of Leadership Theology and Society program at Regent. And he really has a passion for connecting this conversation to blue-collar, working-class work. And he is one of those guys that I really look forward to getting to know over the years and has even given good feedback on our podcast. And so I thought it would be great to do an interview with him. But what happened was the folks at Regent thought it would be really good if we had a conversation together that could be used as their podcast and our podcast. So we had this conversation. So you'll hear multiple voices in there. There's a guy named Octavio, who's an art student at Regent. And then also Claire Perini, she's the assistant dean of students. They're actually facilitating the interview. And so the primary voices will be Gustavo and myself. But if you hear these other voices in there, these are some great people. And Lauren has not taken on a Bolivian accent, and Kimberly has not taken on an Australian accent. These are different folks, great folks that we've gotten to know. And so in this interview with Gustavo, one of the questions that we ask is, what's an overlooked book or chapter of the Bible that could shape our view of work? So I wanted to ask that to you guys before we jumped into the podcast. What do you guys think?
Yeah, so I think that just in general, sometimes the prophets are overlooked, like in kind of whatever topic it is we're talking about. Mm. And so thinking about that and thinking that in some ways, I think Isaiah can be a book that's kind of left out of the conversation a little bit, or at least some of the, like the some themes of it. And so especially when I think of even Isaiah, like living into his calling as a prophet, as a servant to God, as a preacher, that sometimes we can overlook that as calling, or that can be maybe even more like intimidating as calling a vocation. And I think Isaiah sets such a great example of what that is to live into that. And then I think another theme or another thing that we see a lot in Isaiah is God's high expectations of leaders. And so in Isaiah, he's talking, you know, to Israel and talking specifically about government and leaders and the military in that sense. But I think that there's also just so much that that has to say to us today, especially as leaders in ministry and churches and things like that.
Yeah, that's really good. Yeah, how about you, Lauren?
Yeah, I didn't have anything that immediately came to my mind as I was thinking about this, but just now as you were talking and mentioning prophets, I kind of thought of Jonah. I don't know if that's something that's underused, though, necessarily in some ways. I think from the very time, from early on as I became a Christian, people were using, you know, Jonah fleeing the Lord as an example of what not to do. But I think about it, and I kind of have always had sort of a interesting relationship with that verse, because I feel like I almost never have this experience where I have a clear direction that I could even, that you could even write about me, you know, thousands of years from now. He got clear direction. You know, the word of the Lord came to Lauren and he ran away. Like he decided to do the opposite. And in some ways I feel like I just wish, you know, that somebody would just be like, this is what you're supposed to do.
Right. Right.
But you know, in reality, it's much more complicated to figure it out.
Yeah. 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 It's definitely not normative that God steps in and says, go to Nineveh. And then if you don't, you're getting swallowed by a fish. And it's interesting that you say that, because I was just telling that story to my daughter this morning.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting because her question was, She said, what was he thinking about while he was in the fish?
Good question.
What an insightful question. Because it wasn't just like he just sat there for a couple of days and, you know, but that God gave him this merciful moment to sit in the gut of a fish and reflect on his life. And it's interesting. Yeah, I think those are really good. One that pops in mind for me is the book of James, which I think is kind of the New Testament version of the Proverbs. These pithy, wise sayings that are to be reflected on. That hit the whole scope of life, of wisdom, of suffering, of economics, of caring for the poor, of all of these sorts of things. And that's a book that people often care about when they're doing like nonprofit mercy type of work. Mm-hmm. But I think it's one of those books that should be reflected on deeply in all areas of life. Mm-hmm. And Gustavo's way of answering that question is he says the book of Ruth. And he has some really good insights into the book of Ruth. So without any further ado, let's listen in to this conversation that we had with Gustavo and our friends at Regent and how this conversation should connect with the working class.
I thought we'd sort of start with a big picture, a big vision of how do we understand, what's the biblical understanding of work?
Yeah. Well, I think the first thing that comes to mind is people often associate work and employment as the same thing. Mm. But really, work is not just what we're being employed for, but it's any way that we're using our capacities or our efforts to cultivate some good out of God's world or to sustain the good out of God's world. So that includes things like parenting, civic engagement, caring for your home, your garden, your community, as well as the employment aspects of work. So if you differentiate between life being the rhythm of work and rest, it's everything that is not rest, I suppose. What would you add to that?
I think there's something about activity, in a way. It doesn't really matter if you're employed or not. And it has to do with stewardship, in a way. And I think coming from where I come, I think it has a lot to do with curse as well. You know, like just the general understanding is that work is a curse that came after the fall. And actually we see, since the beginning, we see work, good work being done by God first and then by the first people that God put in on earth. So I think there's something about how the biblical story portrays work that's it's very ingrained in the very creation of things, right? Like it has to do with the very nature of who we are, who God is, and what the creation is, in a way. So I think it has this activity, but also this blessing from God, giving us the opportunity to work, in a way, with creation and the things that He created. So I would say that it has to do with the very identity of who we are and who God is, and it's very ingrained in us.
If you talk about Genesis, nobody was getting paid like Adam and Eve and the family, but that was considered work, right?
Yeah.
And so it's very interesting. That's, and then you mentioned like just working from home, taking care of the kids, that's still work, and nobody's getting paid, right? I think we really need to make that change in our head somehow. It's not all about the money.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things I see in Genesis 1 that's so brilliant is there's an explicit invitation to work. Genesis 2:15, that God put man in the garden to work it and to keep it.
Yeah.
That really we weren't just, the world wasn't just created for us, but really we were created for the world. That God created these unique image-bearing creatures whose have this particular responsibility to care for and to develop the potential out of His creation. The other thing that I see is there's an implicit invitation to work in Genesis, in that God does not make everything that would ever be made or every person that would ever be made. And He shows restraint and hospitality and welcomes humanity to sink their hands into the soil of the earth and to cultivate good out mm-hmm. of the potential that he has put in the earth. Mm-hmm. I mentioned this example a lot, but because I love pancakes so much. But I'm not trying to be stereotypical because I'm in Canada. I just legitimately love pancakes. But God hid the potential of maple syrup in the maple tree and was waiting for humanity to discover this great gift and to develop that potential through experimentation, through certain temperatures. Mm. And now every time that we put some syrup on a pancake, we're not just tasting the fruit of good work, we're tasting the hidden potential of God's goodness that he extended to humanity and invited us to draw out.
I love your analogies,
man. Yeah, that in itself is mind-blowing.
It's so true. And it's that idea of being sort of co-creators, like that. That's really helpful, that thing that not everything that exists was or has always been an extent to which there is this co-creation of.
And I think more than that, I think it's just like it's the original plan. It's not something that happened.
Yeah.
You know, it's the way I see like the Bible being like telling the story is that this is the very, it's the designed way. Mm-hmm. This is how God planned. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't something that just happened. Mm-hmm. Oh, I created this. Now I have to work. No, I think it seems to me reading the story since the beginning, it's just like, well, actually God created the world and created us to like with him take care of creation. Mm-hmm. So I don't think he was expecting something different. That's the point. Yeah. When we see this like there by design, it changes our perspective.
Oh yeah.
Totally. And then we've sort of in sort of around Regent and sort of around different parts of the world where this conversation is happening and where there's thinking around work being bigger than this, it's tied to this word vocation. Mm-hmm. So do you want to talk a little bit about this sort of the interplay between work and vocation and what do we mean by vocation maybe to start with and then how those two tie together?
I think a short answer to that would be, for me at least, work is an expression of your vocation. So vocation is something that I see as deeper. It's something that's deep inside of you, like it's God's call for you to participate in his life, in a way, the life of the Trinity and the beautiful dance of the Trinity and all of this. But I think vocation is something that it's deeper. So work can be an expression of your vocation in a way, but not the only expression. So your vocation is bigger than your work. So work is part of your vocation because it has to do with the circumstances you are at. It has to do with the time and place that you are at. Mm-hmm. But your vocation is something that's deeper. It's something that God is calling you to be, not necessarily like to do. Mm-hmm. So it's more, it has to do with your core identity, I would say, and work is more like the expression of that. Mm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the way I like to think of it, this isn't perfect. I'm still working on this a little bit, but Steve introduced me to the concepts of occupation and vocation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. These aren't exactly the same thing, but they're important parts of living before God's face and loving our neighbors through our work. Vocation is the work that we were made to do, like the people we were made to be, the things that we were made to do. And occupation is the work that we must do. It's a part of our responsibility.
Yeah, good.
And it's still very important, very valuable, but it might not be particular to who you are. For instance, I don't know many people who would say that they were uniquely created to change diapers. Mm-hmm. But those who are parents are given the important work of changing diapers, and to do so is very important to that child.
Yeah.
It's not particular to the way that God made them, but it's a part of the good work that they are given to do.
That's a really helpful distinction, both of those. And so the distinction between work and employment and the distinction between vocation and work and yet the interrelationship between those things, it's helpful to sort of just kind of pass those out. How do we understand then success, do we think, at work? So if vocation is kind of something deeper and work might express that and it might not, how do we understand sort of success in terms of our work? How can we understand that?
Well, for me, if we're living this biblical story and the biblical narrative, success has a different expression or a different way of being measured. So I think if vocation is something that kind of defines how God is calling you to participate in his life and life in this world, success would mean being faithful to this calling. So I think the way we measure success from this vocational perspective is like how faithful you are to the calling you're receiving and with the tasks you have at hand, right? Like if you have to change diapers and this is your job, quote unquote, how faithful are you being to this task that was given to you, you know? So in one word, I would say that success, in my understanding from the biblical perspective, means faithfulness. Because I think when I keep saying this, you know, like over and over, and again, like I'm still working on that as well. But I think the last day when Jesus, all said and done, mm-hmm. when we were there, like before Jesus, I don't think he's going to ask, like, did you win? Were you the first? How much
did you make the most money?
Yeah, exactly. So did you make like partner, you know, like mm-hmm. were you the CEO of your company? How many, you know, like this kind of thing. So it doesn't really have to do, in my understanding, and again, like if we are considering the biblical narrative as our story as well, mm-hmm. so that means that the last day we'll have to give account of our faithfulness, mm-hmm. not success in that mm-hmm. sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think faithfulness is a great word. And I think the way that plays out, I can think of some friends recently who've had to make the choice between growing their company or sort of capping their growth because they've realized they've reached the limit of what they can steward.
Oh man.
And so whilst they won't be as financially successful, mm-hmm. Will be successful in that they are faithful in the stewardship of what God has put before them.
Oh man, that's so good, because like I was like in a group and people who are involved with NGOs and educational institutions and, you know, like people doing like the good work and everything. But I asked them this question. I asked, well, if you have to question your goals, would you? Because it seemed to me at that point that the goals were not questioned at any point. Mm-hmm. It's just, well, the goal is given, and then we have to make ourselves like to reach that goal and achieve that. But we never questioned the goal. So my question for them was, would you be able, just what you said, like, would you be able or would you be willing to recalibrate your goal in face of your the structure you have, the people you have, because this is what God gave you.
Yeah,
this absolutely. Is what you're a steward of. Would you question the goals of your organization in face of the structure you have? So that's a very, very
I'm struggling with the idea that drives so many companies, so many athletes, so many churches, which is the goal is being number one. The goal is being the biggest company, the top dog in the market, the biggest church you can be, the best athlete, the best soccer player. So that's goal number one. Your name has got to be at the top. That's what you're aiming for, right? I think that's so ingrained in so many people. And also, I struggle with that feeling of being the alpha dog everywhere I go. And that's kind of what drives so many people. But that's not what you guys are saying. It's not about being the best. But that's so ingrained in everything we are, in everything we do. And even when we start teaching our kids, you got to be the best. And sometimes we camouflage with the best that you can. But, but you know, it's all about being the best. You know what I'm saying? It's not, you got to be faithful with what you have. Have I ever heard a parent say that? Be faithful with what you have? It's like, I don't think I ever have. And I don't know. How do you deal with that? With that mentality of being number one, the best, the alpha dog, the...
Well, you know what's interesting? Well, I'm just the alpha dog anyway and the best.
Exactly. No. Gustavo,
yeah, as so, the best, what
would
you say?
No. What's interesting about that is I heard someone say once that if faithfulness is your goal, let's put it this way, vocational faithfulness, in order to be faithful vocationally, you will necessarily not fulfill your potential.
Hmm. What?
Yes. Like, in order to truly love God and to love others, you are deliberately saying, I will not fulfill my potential. Now, here's what I mean by that. Mm-hmm. Go back to the example of playing, we'll just say with playing with my daughter. Mm-hmm. I am not very skilled at Legos. There are other things that I could be putting my time to mm-hmm. that would be fulfilling my potential mm-hmm. that I will deliberately have to say no to in mm-hmm. order to make sure that my daughter is seen and Legos are played with mm-hmm. and the house is cared for and friends are listened to. Even though that's not necessarily the area of my strength, that's a part of the responsibility that God has put before me. And so I think part of what we should have operative in our mind is a resume of things that will never happen, that will never be done for the sake of loving God and loving others and being faithful to what he's put in front of us. Books that will never be written because you were attentive to your child. Mm-hmm. Promotions that will never be had because of your commitment to integrity. You know, things like that. What's the resume?
Are you just killing me? That's so crazy.
Yeah. I mean, because you make music, right? At the end of the day, if you extracted every bit of energy, of creative energy, and just directed that towards making music, you will probably end up with more albums than you would otherwise. Yeah. But to be faithful to the other aspects of life that God has put before you, it necessarily means that in the end of your life, there will be albums that will never be made that will be a part of your worship of Jesus. Mm-hmm. Pretty crazy, huh?
You're like, oh crap, this is something he's so good and bad at the same time.
Yeah, it's really... Oh, man. And I think this kind of leads into this whole idea of if you don't get to choose your job mm-hmm. or if you're in a job where you don't have influence in the same way, kind of how does this look there? And then it'd be interesting, you guys have both sort of thought about this kind of a theology of faith and work in the working class. And so it'd be interesting mm-hmm. to hear sort of how did you get there and sort of talk to us around that sort of an idea.
Yeah, for me, I think the whole thing about working class started in my own home. I think I grew up in a working class family. Everything I learned about work was with my father and my mother, but didn't have any kind of higher education. It was just like, you know, trying to make the ends meet and everything. But they gave me and my brother like a very good education, so we were able to at some point in our lives to choose our careers, and that's a gift. I can see that now. But I came from a mentality that like work from the place I came from is essentially the way out. So the only way you have like a decent life is to have a good job, right? Because otherwise, and I'm not saying like an okay life, I'm just saying like the barely making it, you know, like in order to escape from poverty, like extreme poverty, you have to find a good job. That's reality in, you know, like the like most of the world is like this, right? So, but I think for me, when I was able then like to choose my career, and then I came here to study marketplace theology, and I was asking these questions about vocation, and I realized that when I was talking about vocation, I was talking about fulfillment. And then when I look back to my parents' lives, they were talking about survival. So the questions were different. Like work had a different role. So for me, it had to do with fulfillment. So how can I use my gifts? How can I be the best or the alpha dog or everything? So how can I feel better about the work I do in a way before God, of course? But when I looked back, I said, "Well, but my parents didn't have that option. Like they were not thinking about fulfillment. They were thinking about about putting food on the table. So, and then like the natural chiasm kind of came. I was just, well, actually, if we're talking about theology of work, that should work for everyone, not only for the fulfillment based questions, but for the survival based questions as well. So it was more like, so when I saw this difference between my own life and my parents' lives, I was just kind of, I started questioning what kind of theology of work we're talking about. Because if it's a theology of work that doesn't embrace all these situations at the same time, it's not good enough. Right. So I think for me, that was where it started, when I was looking at my own family and seeing that that kind of theology of work that I had didn't work or didn't apply in a way to that. So that was for me.
Yeah. You know, very similar. I was raised in a family where almost everybody was, they would be considered working class. My mom worked in the restaurant industry most of my life, and learned a lot about hard work and how to provide for other people from them. And then when I became a believer, I started, eventually I was involved in ministry stuff, and it's a ministry around a university, and that's kind of where my theology of work questions started to be formed. And I realized that a lot of the questions that we were talking about and the ways that we were approaching things had to do with people who had the freedom to choose to, they had a lot of opportunity to choose what work and what field they went into. And it seemed like the operative question was, what's the unique thing that I was made to do, and how does that match with my employment? Well, as I began to think about my family and about some of the folks I grew up with, and I started to bring some of these insights that I was having to them, I realized that it actually brought them a little sense of frustration rather than joy. And was realizing that there are aspects of the biblical story that were not being emphasized in this discussion of faith and work. And that oftentimes even the illustrations we use and the jobs that we lift up are frequently the jobs that are already elevated in society. But the real beauty of the biblical story is to show the brilliance of all kinds of work, even the work that isn't valued by the rest of the world, and how it is deeply valued by God.
And so that's I'd love to hear your thoughts on what aspects of the biblical story have been neglected, and what parts, in this whole conversation, and where might be some places we might look to that would help broaden out this conversation for us.
Yeah, so Gustavo, I think, has some of the best insight into that and has really drawn my attention to some particular books. So I would love it if you took this one.
Okay. Yeah, I was thinking about Ruth, the book of Ruth, and I think it started maybe 2 years ago or so. Like we had a conversation about this as well, Jim and I, and I think I was looking for a story that was not portraying like any kind of leader or someone who was like in a position of power, right? Because, well, same story. I was looking for something that would make sense of my parents' life and people that I knew back in Brazil. So I think, and even though, and that's interesting because even though those stories about, let's say, Moses or Joseph or Daniel or even the apostles, like they're not about power. They're about redemption. All of them are about redemption. But in our society, they are very easily kind of hijacked to a narrative of power and leadership and being the alpha dog. Yeah. And again, like it's the same story, right? So I think I was looking for a story that could help me to see the redemption side of things, but in a way that didn't portray necessarily a leader or someone who was like in a position of power. Because with those stories, this is what happens at the end. People say, you know, be faithful and God will put in a position of power. Yeah, you're going to be the number two or number one, I don't know. And then what really, really struck me was that Ruth, she's a woman, she's an immigrant, she's poor, and she gets the job that's offered just like in order to survive. And she's in between times. Nothing's really happened like in Israel at that point. You know, there's no, you know, you're between like the judges and the next chapter, let's say, in the history. And nothing's really happened. And she doesn't do anything extraordinary in that sense that we usually talk about. You know, like she didn't like direct a country, or she doesn't do anything that's remarkable in that sense. She gets married at the end, and that's it, end of the story, right? So I think what kind of struck me was, as exactly in the other like stories we're talking about, God is the one who does something extraordinary out of people's stories, right? So she's not the hero. God is, and I think this is the theme of the whole Bible, but it's harder to hijack the story, you know, in a way, because like, oh, there's not much like I can take and say. So there's something about the story that's more showing than telling, because there's no judgment as well about like Ruth's actions. But she's faithful. And for example, thinking about her decisions to follow Naomi, for example, it wasn't a decision made based on like economic return, because it wasn't good for her to go to another country as an immigrant, as a woman, super vulnerable in many ways. You know, some people say that Naomi didn't want her to go with her Ruth because it would be more like a burden. You know, she was kind of concerned about Ruth. We never know, but it could be an explanation as well. And the story doesn't really judge Orpah, you know, that didn't go with Naomi. So there's no kind of judgment in there. But you can see that Ruth makes the decision out of her faithfulness to the story that she was looking at. So I have someone here who needs help, you know, and everything kind of begins with the tragedy. Right? Like they lose family. They lose like, so there's vulnerability everywhere. And I think that's how the working class in many ways feels. It's just like, we're vulnerable. Anything that happens to the poor is like 10 or 20 times worse because they don't have like support, you know, the economic support or social support. So every tragedy, let's say like a family tragedy that happens to the poor, is much worse because you don't have this kind of net of support. So I think that's why that story really caught my attention, because it's something that reflects many of the questions we have today.
Yeah, absolutely. So if someone was going to sit down with the Book of Ruth, and you could give them one or two questions to be asking as they read the Book of Ruth, what would those questions be?
Oh, gosh.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. There you go.
What faithfulness looks like for Ruth.
Yeah, that's good.
What kind of decisions she makes throughout the story that show that she's faithful to the things that she has in her hands?
Brilliant, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I think that's a question, because I think there's something about her reading of the situation that's very insightful. She's wise. She makes like what she can do in order to survive in that context, knowing what were the consequences for her decisions. So I think there's a lot of wisdom in there. And I think the question will be like the same for the reader, let's say, about his or her own life, like what faithfulness looks like in my own life now. So looking at the situations I have around me, what can I do to show faithfulness?
That's really good. Because I think a lot of the times people approach the questions of work and vocation of how can I manipulate the situation and the circumstances so that I can do what I really want to do. But this has the assumption of these circumstances are out of your control and can't be manipulated by you. What does faithfulness look like? That's good.
Because it, like in the back of the story, you have God being the one who's taking care of everyone. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Right? Like, if you have, like, from the beginning to the end, like, you have this perception of a presence of God or providence that's not necessarily, like, explicit there, but it has, like, this background and saying, well, God is taking care of you and of you all and this history in a broader sense. So I think, and you can always have like two options, right? Like you can look at life through the lens of faith, and then you're going to say that's providence. Or you can say, if you choose not to look through the lens of faith, you're going to say that's luck or hard work or, you know, just random stuff that happens to you. But if you have faith, it becomes providence. It becomes God's care and everything.
You make me want to go just immerse myself in the Book of Ruth.
That's good.
This afternoon, absolutely.
You know what I was thinking? In a lot of sermons that I've heard, the main thing about Ruth is that she was the great-grandmother of David.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, that's what she's there for. Mm-hmm. She's the grandma of David. But now that you're talking, we're going again to the leader. Mm-hmm. To the David, yeah. We're not at least in those sort of sermons. Like, it's just a normal story. But the important thing is that she was the great grandma of David.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that's just dumb. It's like you're saying, like we're somehow finding a way of taking the story and pulling it to a leader again, to the strong man, to the. So I totally get that our tendency of doing that.
Totally. And Jim, are there any books that you've kind of that have been helpful for you in thinking about this question as well?
Yeah, I would say it would be wisdom literature in general.
Mm-hmm.
So I would include Proverbs, Job, Ecclesiastes, but even the wisdom teaching of Jesus and the book of James, which is kind of like the Proverbs of the New Testament. Mm-hmm. And the reason being is that some of the best teaching on work and economics comes from these books, and how to do life. Really, what it is, wisdom literature is essentially, it's seeing the patterns and the norms of creation, and encapsulating it in these pithy, rich statements that are intended to be remembered, memorized, ruminated over. And I think the power there is that these are statements that people can sit with the entire day.
Mm-hmm.
And while you're cleaning dishes, while you're building something, while you're driving a truck, you can have this phrase, this sentence that is shaping your life, that you're savoring throughout the day. And you might not have the freedom or the ability to open up a text and to be reading all day long, but you can keep this one sentence with
that's
you. And I think that that's how humans work. A lot of times we are shaped not by abstract, big ideas and things like that, but it's sentences that change our life. And I think in the absence of really having these wisdom statements, these proverbs, these aphorisms operative in our life, what happens is the proverbs that are a part of a different story other than the biblical story actually seep into our mindset and are shaping us. And I think that if we spoke the language of James, of Jesus, of the proverbs, then that sort of wisdom would show us what God's world is like, how it works, and help us to reflect on how we live with wisdom within it.
Can you give us some stories from your own life? So we've talked about some biblical stories that show that faithfulness. Are there stories that you've heard of just faithful work in whatever sphere, in whatever field?
I think back to my dad, I would say that he's he's doing good work as well. And it's interesting because he had like three moments in his career or his professional life. And he worked for a drugstore first, and then he had a career at Kodak, you know, no longer. And then now he is the administrator for a daycare in the very same neighborhood that he grew up. So he knows those kids' situation. He knows like it's a very poor community, and it's a way that he found of, in a way, kind of giving back to that neighborhood in a way, using his skills, of course, but also his heart for just doing good work in a sense that's helpful. So what he does is just like, you know, keep things running. You know, it's a very maintenance kind of job. You don't have like big kind of aspirations. You're not kind of trying to grow or anything like that. It's just like taking care of kids day in, day out, right? So I think there's something about, and then like when I think of him, I think about like all these people, they're just quote unquote doing their job. They just keep the fabric of society like intact in a way, right? So people who are just doing their job, quote unquote, are actually keeping us safe in many ways, like socially speaking, right? Like the fabric of society is kind of based on the things that people do every day in order to maintain. And this kind of reflects God's character as well. Yeah. Like the sun is up, the sun is down, like every day.
Right.
God is kind of maintaining the world in a way. So I think maintenance jobs, I would say, are usually overlooked in that way. But actually, they keep us like living well and in peace in a way. And I also think about all those people who are now part of what we would call like the working class, but they're working in offices, right? Because the working class for us kind of immediately has like the image of like someone who's doing like heavy duty jobs and, you know, like, you know, dirty clothes and everything. But actually we have a new working class coming out. Right, the new working class works in offices in front of like computers all day long, doing spreadsheets, you know, and they're using actually white collar now, right? They're not blue collars anymore, but they are, as I said, in a way keeping the fabric of society kind of working and intact in a way, just because they're quote unquote doing their job.
I'll give you two little stories, examples of that. One is a guy I know named Jeff who works in manufacturing anchor bolts. And these are bolts that are, they're sort of, they go into, I might butcher it explaining it, they go into concrete and they hold things like large objects into the ground, like street lights and buildings, and giant bolts. And so he manufactures these bolts, and I was having a conversation with him, and I, you know, it was interesting. I was asking him questions about his work. Later that day, I was going on a walk, a little prayer walk in the evening, and I go this kind of crazy route back by these railroad tracks where there's not a lot of stuff going on, and I accidentally stumbled upon somebody who was experiencing homelessness. They were asleep out there, and I startled them as I walked up. They jumped up and they threw a rock at the guy, not they, he threw a rock at me as hard as he could. And I saw the rock coming, and I dodged it a little bit to the left, and it just flew past me. The guy was, he was just startled. But what I realized was there was a street light that allowed for me to see that rock coming.
Wow.
And if I wouldn't have seen that rock, it would have hit me square in the nose and made my nose more distorted than it already is. But the reality was that light was being held in the ground through an anchor bolt that was probably created by my friend. And the buildings that we're in, the lights that provide us safety, are being held by God through the gift of an anchor bolt that he gives. And everything, everywhere we go. Right now, there's the work of a structural engineer who did some work in the building that we're in, that we can be here in safety, knowing that the ceiling's not going to collapse in on our head. And, you know, those are the heroic stories, literally saving our life in this moment that we'll never even know about.
I have a question. There's a narrative that's a little bit stressful for a lot of people, that is, you should be in a better job. You should be getting promoted. You should be, and if you're not, if you don't want to move it, that's because you're not hungry enough. You don't want to be as successful as you could be. So it's like your job right now is not good enough. You're not getting paid enough. You're not in the best position you could be. And it's always telling people that wherever you're at, it's not the ideal place. You should get a better place. And sometimes it's even fighting against the sense that I really like what I'm doing, but I'm being told I'm not hungry enough. So somehow there's something wrong with me for not desiring something better of what society calls it better. That's what I'm saying. So sometimes it's stressful for a lot of people, maybe including myself, of you should be aiming for the stars and all the time, because that's a healthy person. What people should be doing, aiming for the highest job you can, aiming for and moving along, right? The food chain or whatever. What do you have to say against that? Because I know that is stressful, putting that pressure on people that is not coming out of them. It's society or some voices out there telling them you should be aiming higher. But they like their jobs, but it's still stressful.
Yeah, I think it all comes back to what story you're living out of, right? So the narrative we have today, and we talked a little bit about like leadership and being the alpha and everything. It's a narrative that's not the biblical narrative. It doesn't come out of God's story. So this is not the story that we are a part of. So if we believe that this is the narrative that we should follow, then everything's going to be like that, you know, like I have to do this. I have to, I worked many years like in the consulting business, and it was very common to hear the phrase up or out.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Like that was very common, the corporate sector. But the thing is, this is the narrative that they are living out of. So the narrative of scarcity, you know, that you have to be the first one or the best one, otherwise you won't survive. The narrative that you have to fulfill your potential, as Jim mentioned. The narrative that you have to crush others in order to be yourself, you know, because it is a competition. And that's interesting because we usually say that it's a competition, but there's no finish line, right? Like nobody wins because there's no, so it's just like a parenthesis here. But it's interesting the narrative we have. So if we believe that, that's going to be the our MO, like the way we do things. But if we think and we reframe our understanding of the story in a way that we see, well, actually, I'm going to leave out of the biblical narrative and the biblical tradition or the biblical story. And faithfulness, again, becomes the goal in a way. So those stories don't have like any impact on that anymore. Like being the first, not necessarily. I have to be good as a person. I don't have to be the best. I could be the best. There is nothing wrong with that, you know. But that's not the case. That's not my goal. That's not what God is calling me to do necessarily, you know. So I think it depends on like the background story you're having, like the back of your mind. Like, okay, what story am I a part of? And then this story, this narrative, kind of drives all the decisions you make as well. So. But it is stressful because everything else around us tells us like the other way, right?
Yeah.
It's totally different.
Yeah, I was thinking, we were talking about, I wanted you to mention the story of you watching the Oscars and the Lady Gaga thing you saw.
Yeah.
Can you talk about it a little bit?
Yeah, it was like a speech of like, well, you know, if you fight hard enough, if you do, you know, like... And she actually quoted Rocky, you know, like it doesn't matter how many times you fall, like it's more about like how many times you get up and do your thing. And as if hard work is enough for you to be successful in this world. So this is totally kind of ignoring the brokenness of this world in a way, because like many people would not have the chances she had, the opportunities she had. I'm not saying that was an easy life. I'm not saying that. But the thing is, first, the whole thing about success that we have talked about already, but also, like, if you have to acknowledge that this world is a broken world, you have to say that not everyone can do or be the best.
Yeah, by definition, not everyone
can be. Right?
Yeah. By definition... Almost everybody's below, half of the people are below average.
Exactly.
In any given thing.
Yeah, and what he was saying was, we're talking about when Lady Gaga won the Oscar for for best score, best song?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Something like that. And what we're talking about is like, she's saying that, and she winning that Oscar per se, it meant that she outworked everybody that year,
yeah.
Which is not true.
Yes.
We were talking about all the circumstances around her, the country she's in, the people she knows, and there's so many factors that are not just about how hard you work.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's not just work as hard as you can and you're going to make it. It's not true. There's so many things, so many cards laying around that are going to influence whatever happens to you.
And where that idea comes from is it comes from the Enlightenment and how the Western story is functionally a narrative that is competing with the biblical story to be the dominant narrative of our life. Mm-hmm. And the Western story emphasizes things like human autonomy, that individual autonomy, that I am my own, and if I just exert my will and my autonomy, I can make the world whatever I want it to be. And things like that. Also things of kind of like the survival of the fittest. And that's the way that the world works, is you have to get yours without regard to others. And that it's a zero-sum situation, that there's almost, that there's only so much money out there. There's only so much time and fruitfulness and those sorts of things. And you've got to get yours.
Yes.
But rather we are, the biblical vision of the world is that we are a people who are made to be dependent on God and connected with one another. And oftentimes what happens when people choose to climb the ladder as fast as they can, I mean, and climbing the ladder is not necessarily, it's not wrong, but just to assume that that's the good in and of itself, a lot of times what happens is the focus on the individual leads to less fruitfulness. So I'll just take my world, for example, with churches and church planting. A lot of times people will think faithfulness for me is to eventually, you know, as a pastor, become a lead pastor and plant a church and become the main preacher and everything like that. But what we've found is that when some people really can thrive in their area and not say, how can I just climb the ladder for me, but really focus more on what does fruitfulness look like together. You can have a much richer, fruitful work paying attention to the relationships that you're in. And the last thing I would say is I think sometimes our metaphors for success and our images of success are off. We often look at the quarterback, the most able-bodied person on a football team. And the most, you know, front and center. What about looking at an offensive lineman as a metaphor? So if you don't know football, an offensive lineman is the only person on the team who has no individual statistics and can only depend on the success and flourishing of others to note the fruitfulness of their work. They're blocking, they're creating the path for others. Other things like that. Why it's good to look at the boardroom, but also it might be good to look at the garden as a metaphor. It might be good to look at the most physically able-bodied person, but also the person who's taught me the most about work and vocation is my daughter on the autism spectrum. And her struggles to write the letter E have taught me more than many others have. So anyway, I'm rambling here, but yeah.
Just as we're closing, Jim, you were saying earlier about Proverbs and that whole idea of a sentence being so helpful. And that's really how we learn, through sentences, not necessarily through pages and pages of books, but through ideas and sentences. If there was sort of a couple of theological sentences or ideas that would be just helpful in nourishing people in the work that they're doing in whatever sphere, what would they be?
Ooh, that's a good question. Let's see. I'll throw a few of them out there. Gordon Spykman has a great one. He says, "Nothing matters but the kingdom, but because of the kingdom, everything matters." That's a good one. Steve Garber has, there's a lot of Garberisms.
Garberianisms.
But I mean, the question that he always asks that always sits with me is knowing what you know, what are you going to do?
Yeah, that's my favorite.
Mm-hmm. Yeah?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, why is that?
Well, I think it has a lot in there because it has to do with discernment. Like, mm-hmm. so you have to be able to see what's around you and that you're implicated. Mm-hmm. You have a responsibility, yeah. you know, in front of the things that you're seeing or hearing. Or so I think it has both elements of being attentive and responding. Mm-hmm. So that's why I love it. I think it's very insightful in that way.
Anything more from you, Gustavo?
Camarón que se duerme, se lo lleva la corriente. I'll say that because he's trying to learn Spanish.
Exactly.
No, barriga llena, corazón contento.
Oh, that's the one.
Yes.
So I would say that another Gerberian phrase would be being implicated by love's sake.
Mm. Hmm.
Oh, yeah.
And again, it has to do with responsibility, and it has to do with the reason why we are implicated. We are implicated because of love.
Mm.
You know, so God loves us and he invites us to participate in his life. And it's not a command as in like you should do this because I'm telling you to do, but it's like I'm inviting you. It's totally different. Mm-hmm. Right? It's not a command, it's more like an invitation. So all this like you have around you is for you to play with, to work with. You know, and you have the freedom to choose. So many, many times, like when I'm doing work stuff or I see someone like reacting to something, I just think, well, of all things, you chose this one.
Mm-hmm.
Why? You know, like, why did you say that? Why did you feel that way? Why? You know, like sometimes we kind of overlook the reasons why we do things. But we have a choice. We always have a choice. It's kind of cheesy, but we always have a choice. Of all things you have to do, like in front of you, like why do you decide to do this or that? So love should inform that as well. So.
Yeah.
So good.
Gustavo and Jim, thanks for your time.
Thanks. Thanks for letting me be here.
Thank you for this great conversation, guys. Yeah. Thank you so much.
We hope you enjoyed today's podcast. Before we sign off, we wanted to let you know that we would really appreciate any feedback you have for us. In particular, it would really help us out if you left a comment and gave a rating on iTunes. It will help us get the word out. A 5-star rating would be awesome, but we appreciate honesty. Also, if you are seeking some clarity about your work and calling, we would love to connect with you and help provide some career coaching. You can find out more about the career coaching at faithworkrest.com. Until next time, we pray that God would help you discern your vocation, reimagine every aspect of your occupation, and give you rich, life-giving rhythms of rest. We pray that your work would glorify God and seek the good of your neighbor. See you next week.